Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to the programme. And my thanks to David Aldous for Passages of Life, Tony Miles for The Big Breakfast on Premier. And of course, there's plenty more to come this Saturday afternoon here on Premier. If you want to stick around, you can hear, of course, Moira continuing his trip around the world. And later on this afternoon, Dave is here with Hip Rock UK, playing the very best in young people's Christian music, hip-hop, rock, that sort of thing. And don't forget that immediately after this programme, at about 3.30, you can hear that short programme from Father John Twistleton, Firmly I Believe. And I'll remind you how you can get that hold of that on CD as well, if you do want to get hold of the full double CD. Right now, though, it's time for Unbelievable, the show where Christians and non-Christians get together to talk. You're unbelievable. And today, joining me on the show is Hemant Mehta. He sold his soul on eBay, and that's the title of his book, I Sold My Soul on eBay. What he did was offer himself up for auction, and to the highest bidder, he agreed to go to their church. Well, in the end, a pastor bought his soul and asked him to visit a number of churches in the Chicago area where he lived. And he's written a book about his experiences as an atheist visiting these churches, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So we're going to be asking in our programme today, how well do churches represent God and Christianity, and how do they communicate it? Now, helping us to engage with Hemant is Tom Price of the Damaris Trust. It's going to be a really interesting conversation today here on Unbelievable. And as I say, I've been looking forward to this one for a while now. Hemant calls himself the friendly atheist. We'll be finding out why from him a little bit later on in the programme. But the book itself is actually published by a Christian publisher, and it gives an idea of why Hemant, in a sense, is so open to talking and dialoguing, and that's what we like on Unbelievable, the fact that he'd be prepared for a Christian publisher to publish his book, and indeed that a Christian publisher has published an atheist, as it were, points of view on church. In fact, the foreword is given by Rob Bell, who's, of course, teaching pastor at Mars Hill Bible Church, and the face on the Numa DVDs, which many people have seen. I'll just read out some of Rob's own foreword from the book. Rob says, I knew I would love talking with Hemant long before I met him. I have much in common with atheists. What I find time and again is that the God they've rejected is a God I've rejected. The God who doesn't encourage intellectual honesty. The God who doesn't care about the environment because it's all going to burn. The God who calls the anemic words of bored worshippers going through the motions praise. The God who would condemn billions of people to hell simply because they haven't said or done the proper ritual that Christians can't even agree on. Some gods should be rejected. And that, of course, is what makes Hemant's book so compelling. It's not just that he's smart, insightful and honest. It's that so much of what he says is, well, true. What will strike you in the pages of this book is that Hemant isn't angry or antagonistic. As you try to figure out what exactly his agenda is, you'll probably arrive at the same conclusion I did. I think he's simply after the truth. So there you go, part of the foreword there in the book. And we'll be finding out from Hemant himself what things turned him on to churches. This is particularly churches in the States that he visited, and what things turned him off, and where he stands now in his atheism. And as I say, Tom Price of the Damaris Trust will be joining me as well as we chat to Hemant. Last week we were talking about miracles, and I had on with me skeptic Stephen Pilcher, who was telling us exactly what he thinks about miracles, namely that they're pretty much in the person's mind. You know, it's the power of suggestion and that kind of thing at these charismatic events where people claim healing. We also had John Ryland of the Christian Healing Mission, who was telling us about his own personal experiences of healing, and we had some first-hand accounts of healing, of course. Well, many of you have wanted to respond to this. Fortunately, haven't got room for all of your responses, but here's first of all, just to get us started, a couple of accounts of healing from a couple of people who phoned up our response line.
Hello, my name is Tony Wernham. I've had two definite healings by God's healing power. One, I was paralysed from the spine after an operation, and the hospital doctors didn't think I'd walk again. They were going to tell the other patients the day after. In fact, I began to get toe movement. And secondly, I had a kidney problem with the other kidney. They wanted to operate. They couldn't do it on that day. The specialist asked me to come down to see him 5 days later with the plates. And when I arrived, after I'd been prayed for and laid hands on in the church, for church friends, I was found to be healed completely, the kidney, of the disease on the second kidney. So I just want to say thank you, Lord, and to encourage people who to go on praying for healing.
I have been healed from a long-standing depression. I suppose I had it for more than 15 years. And when I came to Christ in 2004, I have not needed antidepressants or anything remotely like them. The joy bubbles up inside in a quite indescribable way that really can't be explained in any logical way, certainly not by my general practitioner.
Well, thank you very much for those accounts of healing, and I think they demonstrate both the physical and mental types of healing, I suppose, that many people would claim that faith gives them. A couple of people wanted to know more about John Ryland's own healing ministry. Let me give you the web address for that. That's healingmission.org. That's healingmission.org. So that's the place to go if you want to find out more about it. And they run a very popular ministry there. Let's hear some more of your accounts of healing as they came in on our phone lines.
Hello, my name is Marianne Ali. My godmother in France is a doctor who for many years was part of a committee verifying the miraculous healings in Lourdes, in Lourdes, southwest France, with the Virgin Mary. And they were extremely strict to actually give a sort of go-ahead for a miracle. He has seen things like internal organs regrowing, which actually were partly missing or which were no longer there after a huge cancer, for example. Things which are totally, totally unexplainable from a rational point of view.
My name is Olga. A friend of mine became very ill and went to the doctors, who said she had a very serious heart condition and had a pacemaker fitted in. So I went up, saw her, and she really couldn't even climb up the stairs. However, she went up to a healing session and they prayed hands and laid hands on her. And I went back to see her. This woman was up and down and she was cooking, washing, climbing the stairs. And we asked her what happened. And she said that this Sunday she went and saw this, went to this meeting. And she said all she knew, she woke up and said, "Lord, I believe, I believe." And full in morning she got up. And there was no problem.
Thank you for those views, Marianne and Olga. I'm afraid, Olga, your message obviously cut out there towards the end. And if you do leave me a voicemail message, there's a sort of 2-minute time limit. So if you can get your call to within that, that's fine. But if you do cut out, you know, just ring up again and finish off what you were saying. If you want to get in touch with the programme, maybe you've got a story of healing or a miracle that you'd like to share with us, and I will be passing these on to our guests who were on the programme with me last week, then you can ring in as well, 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5, or you can email me, that's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, you can listen back to that programme on healing and whether it shows proof of the existence of God, whether miracles can really be verified. That was the subject, and a fascinating program it was. Do go on to the Unbelievable webpage, that's premier.org.uk/radio, and click on Unbelievable. Once again, premier.org.uk/radio, and click on Unbelievable. You can listen to, I think there's almost 25 programs now of archive programs that you can listen to or download as MP3 files to your music player and listen on the go. So that's the way to do it if you want to get in touch. Again, the numbers are there as well on the webpage if you want to do that. Well, time to meet our guests very shortly. Before we do that, let me say that I did mention earlier that if you want to get hold of the Firmly I Believe CD series by Father John Twistleton, they're available. Again, they're available through our Premier shop or online. Go to premier.org.uk/Firmly I Believe. That's premier.org.uk/Firmly I Believe. And you can pick up a copy of those, that double CD, in time for Christmas. Well, I wonder what an atheist would make of your Sunday morning service if they were to walk through the doors. Well, that's exactly what Hemant Mehta did for about a year of his life. Walked into Sunday morning services in churches of all different kinds and reported back on his experiences as an atheist. We're going to be meeting him very shortly, as well as Tom Price of the Damaris Trust. But here now is the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity, connecting us with culture. And this is Nigel Hopper's thoughts on a couple of disasters in this last week. You'll probably know the ones I'm referring to. And Henry Devereux is reading his thoughts. That's Connecting with Culture this week.
Connecting with Culture.
It's been a bad week for football-loving families. First, you're hit with the news that HM Revenue and Customs have lost CDs containing personal data, such as your name, address, date of birth and bank account details, along with those of the other 25 million UK citizens who received child benefit. Then you have to watch in horror and disbelief as England are beaten 3-2 by Croatia, and so failed to qualify for Euro 2008. Even before Wednesday's game, there was a general consensus that if England lost, then Steve McClaren would have to go. So it's no surprise that he's gone, along with his assistant, Terry Venables. This, we have come to believe, is what it means to take responsibility. Interesting, then, to compare this with the political arena, where the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, has neither been sacked nor resigned over the missing CDs. Instead, talk is of a single maverick junior official operating a contravention of the rules. In other words, it wasn't the Chancellor's fault. Is Mr. Darling failing to take responsibility, or is he simply honestly identifying the cause of the problem and now taking responsibility by heading up efforts to resolve it? How comfortable would any of us be with sacrificing our career because of the mistakes of others? For that matter, is Mr. McLaren really to blame? Why not the players? Or the grumbling supporters? Or the FA chief executive? Both these scenarios cause us to reflect on the extent to which our culture now dictates that to take responsibility for mistakes made is to deny oneself the opportunity to make reparation for those mistakes. It seems that in equating taking responsibility with reaching the end of the road, we've exiled repentance from the field of public truth. It now sits on the bench, watching the action from the confines of our private religiosity, where it is undoubtedly of great personal comfort. But we are to love others as ourselves. Surely this extends to allow them to experience the joys and possibilities opened up by repentance. Too often, perhaps, we worry that our willingness to create opportunities for repentance to work will be construed by others as allowing those at fault to evade their responsibilities. Nothing, of course, could be further from the truth. Nothing, that is, but the lack of grace evidenced by our outlawing of repentance.
That was Connecting with Culture, brought to you by the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity. Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. And a really interesting program for you this afternoon. Joining me is Hemant Mehta. He's the author of I Sold My Soul on eBay. Hails from Chicago, grew up in the Jain religion, but lost his faith as a teenager to become an atheist. And a few years ago, he decided he should at least explore other avenues of belief, and so had the idea of putting his soul up for auction on the internet auction website eBay. Well, we'll find out more about that story from Hemant. He's our atheist on the programme today, and we're going to be looking at the subject of how the church communicates God, especially to non-believers. And we'll hear about exactly why Hemant put himself through almost a year, pretty much, of going to church services as an atheist. Also with us is Tom Price from the Damaris Trust. Tom is an evangelist and apologist with that organisation. But first of all, let's say hello to Hemant, who joins us on the phone from the States. A very good afternoon to you, Hemant.
Hi, Justin. Thank you for having me.
Hemant, I've been fascinated by your story ever since I came across it on the internet. Tell us, when did this all start?
This all started about a year and a half ago. And basically, the reason I even wanted to go to church in the first place is in America, I work with a couple atheist organizations, one of them that focuses on kind of communicating atheism to college students. Not in like an evangelical sort of way, but, you know, there are atheists already who go to college, and my job with this group called the Secular Student Alliance is to just try to get them forming groups together so they can meet each other and, you know, hold debates, hold events on campus. And I also work with a lobbying group that works in Washington, D.C. And so, you know, when you work with those groups, you realize, you know, I realized in the past 5 years, I've met a lot of atheists that come from Christian backgrounds. So, you know, I've heard a lot about Christianity from them, but you never know if what you hear from them is, you know, is it just a one-sided perspective? How biased is it? And I just wanted to see what church was like on my own. So I decided to go to church, and, you know, the eBay route is the way I went about doing that.
It's very amusing because it picked up, obviously, a lot of press attention in the end. And essentially, the story is that you kind of volunteered to go to church, or to a place of worship, in fact, because you weren't exclusively looking at Christianity, for $10 a pop, I think. But things kind of spiraled to the point where the bid eventually was over $500.
Yeah, I had no idea that they would attract that much attention, and I really didn't do it for the publicity or for the money. I mean, the money was donated. But yeah, I said I would go to church or a mosque or a synagogue for basically $10 a day or $10 an afternoon, whatever it came out to be. And it just turned out that Christians were the only ones that wanted to bid on me going to their place of worship. And you also had atheists bidding that I don't go to church, and basically the two sides set each other off, and the price kept jumping.
Well, eventually you were bought, to use, for want of a better word, by Jim Henderson, who's a pastor in the States. And he kind of changed slightly what you had in mind. So tell us what happened in the end.
Right. Well, Jim won the auction for $504, and so I basically owed him, you know, if you want to say 50 Sundays worth of services.
Mm.
And Jim said, you know what, I used to be an evangelical pastor. I wouldn't want to put you through that. So tell you what, why don't you go, instead of going to 50 services, why don't you go to 10 to 15 services, but we'll make them all different ones. Like, don't go to the same church twice. And in return, I would basically write about my experiences at these 10 or 15 different churches on his ministry's website called Off the Map. And that sounded really good to me, and it sounded good to him, and that's what we ended up doing.
And eventually your experiences have been, as it were, crystallized into your book, I Sold My Soul on eBay. Well, we're going to get into the meat of what it's all about, and particularly the ways that you describe in the book of how churches did things right in some ways in terms of putting the message out to non-believers, but also the things you think churches get wrong. And we'll be looking at that in some detail. Also with us, though, as I've said on the program today, is our Christian guest, Tom Price from the Damaris Trust. First time on the program. Thank you very much, Tom, for being with me.
It's great to be with you.
And you've been, I know, studying Hemant's story with some interest as well. But tell us your story briefly for yourself, Tom. How did you come to be working for the Damaris Trust?
Well, I arrived at university 7 years ago as a mature student, and I wasn't a Christian believer. I was somewhere between atheism, agnosticism, and in many ways I was open to these questions, as it seems to me that Hemant is. And as I started to study philosophy, as I started to engage with the questions that it's possible to engage with in the university environment, I found that My journey into the questions, what is the soul, is right and wrong real, or are they just feelings? Is there something that created the universe? And is are our deepest desires for meaning and significance in life answered by something? And I started to find that this journey started to point me towards the historical person of Jesus Christ. And to cut a quite a long story short, over a number of years, I gradually moved towards Christian belief and finally decided that the point had come when I needed to confess with my life what I had come to believe in my mind. And so, in some ways reluctantly, decided that I needed to become a Christian, because the truth and reality for me was a principle that had to come before how I felt.
So your journey, very much an intellectual one to begin with.
To begin with, absolutely, yes, that's true.
But coming to mean something in the heart eventually.
Yes.
Well, it's great to have you on, and you now in your role really continuing really the way you started, providing an intellectual defence in some ways for Christian faith.
I think so. That's what I do now. I spend a lot of time with people at university, skeptics asking questions, as well as Christians who are asking questions about their faith. Because quite often Christians go through a journey where they take on or inherit the faith of their parents, and they're sort of going through the motions, and suddenly get to their teenage years or university stage and suddenly wonder whether or not it's really true, as the questions of life, who am I, what should I do with my life, start to bite and start to dig in, then often people go through quite a profound and deep struggle with their faith. And my work is largely related to helping people to think through questions of life and faith, and not just obscuring the answers with some sort of vague idea of faith, but coming very much from the New Testament point of view, that faith is something that is profoundly logical and rational, and that involves our mind as a part of a worship of God that will incorporate the rest of our soul too.
Well, it's great to have you with me, and thank you very much for coming along, and thanks also to Hemant, who is on the phone from the States. And I'm just really looking forward to our conversation this afternoon as we look at Hemant's book, I Sold My Soul, on eBay. You can actually get it through the Premier Shop if you'd like to do it that way. That's online at premier.org.uk/shop, because it is actually published by a Christian publisher, and in a sense I'd love to ask Hemant as we go about that whole process as well. But we're asking this afternoon on the show, how well does the church communicate God? And we're going to be getting a look at faith through an atheist's eyes from Hemant, who had that experience that he's been telling us. So do join us again in just a moment after.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
A very short break.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
That's right. This is the show where Christians talk to non-Christians. It's a place for discussion, debate, dialogue. And that's certainly something our atheist guest would approve of today, because his book very much aims at making a dialogue a place of space for Christians and atheists to talk together. That's Hemant Mehta. His book, I Sold My Soul on eBay, talks about how he gave up his religious beliefs as a teenager, became an atheist, and then went on to explore Christianity by way of going to various churches around the state to see how well they communicate God, faith and Jesus Christ. He did that by auctioning his soul, though it wasn't quite like that, but it was certainly something that had grabbed media attention at the time. And he's written up his experiences of these church visits, and it contains many interesting things that I think Christians need to be looking at about what churches do and don't do as far as their attempts to reach non-believers. So he's my guest on the programme today, Hemant Mehta. Also with me, Tom Price from the Damaris Trust, a Christian evangelist and apologist. And he's going to be speaking with Mehta as they talk about how the church conveys God to people. Hemant, before we go directly into the book, online you call yourself the friendly atheist. Is that because you feel many atheists these days are not very friendly?
Actually, no. You know, it's actually quite the opposite. I started the website friendlyatheist.com, and the reason for that name was actually because I get the perception from Christians that they think a lot of atheists, you know, it's so often in American media anyway, that you always see the word atheist if they're describing someone preceded by angry atheist or militant atheist or something like that. And having worked with atheists for a really long time now, pretty much all the atheists I've met are completely the opposite. They're actually very nice. And when I started doing this auction on eBay and started going to these churches, a lot of people kept telling me, you go against the grain. You're not as angry as all the other atheists I know. And it was funny because the atheists I know are very nice and they are very kind people. So I thought friendly atheist was just a way of putting those two words together so they stick in people's minds. It's not because I was friendly as opposed to other atheists. It's because those are usually what atheists are, in my point of view. So it's not because I was some exception to the rule.
I don't know whether you'd agree, Tom, but in my perception, maybe this reason for Christians having an idea of an angry atheist is because certainly some of the recent literature from the likes of Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris does seem quite angry. Tom, would you agree with that? Or
certainly things are written in a spirit of diatribe and venting rather than let me hear your point of view. And I think that the reluctance of some of those atheists to engage in higher level debate with Christian apologists like William Lane Craig also points towards that.
I mean, do you approve of what some of these other writers are coming out with at the moment, Hemant?
Well, you know, let me say, I know Dawkins has said one thing about how, you know, people will say that he's coming off as angry or hostile, and they're kind of mistaking that for his passion for this subject because, you know, he does say some strong words, but again, it's kind of to make a point, and you're not used to hearing people say that. And I know with my experience with atheists such as Dawkins, one of the problems with debating Christians is not that they don't want to do it or they don't feel they can defend themselves. It's more that the very nature of that debate alone, just the fact that they're having it, they usually get taken out of context. They have really bad experiences, and it's not because of what the outcome is of the debate. It's just the very fact that they agree to it in the first place and just the aftermath of it. In terms of the PR spin from the Christian side is often very negative, despite whatever the atheists have said. But, you know, I've seen those debates take place. I've seen atheists do very well in those things. I'm actually very glad that those books are out there from the likes of Dawkins and Harris, only because it gets that message out that, you know what, there are a number of atheists out there, and it's okay to be an atheist. And I think that's a message of the book that kind of gets lost because of the tone that they take. But in America, anyway, I've seen people talking about atheism in a way I've never seen in the 10 years or so that I've been an atheist, only because those books are out there and they are as strong as they are. You didn't see that happening the first 8 years anyway that I was an atheist. So despite the tone, and yeah, I like some of it, I don't like some of it, but I'm really glad that it's out there only because it gets people talking about it and it allows, you know, it allows people like me to get my message across. It allows people, you know, there are now books about how to be an atheist parent. They're books about, you know, how to have relationships.
Yeah, it's becoming something of an industry. I mean, Tom, you're nodding in agreement there.
Yes, absolutely. I think that if we can get these questions out into the public sphere, then that's a debate that's worth having.
It goes without saying you're an atheist, Hemant. Interestingly, the book was published by a Christian publisher, and in many ways, the point of the book is to help Christians make their message or their church services more relevant to non-Christians. Now, that's an interesting goal. It's not possibly one that would be shared by Richard Dawkins, is it?
No, probably not. But you know what? I got to say this. You know, the Christian publisher didn't censor me at all. They let me say whatever I wanted to say. With one exception, if I can share that really quickly, I went to one church, and it was the church of an evangelical preacher who talks on TV all the time, and, you know, he gave his story. You know, I love listening to this guy. He has a very positive message every week, despite the fact that he believes in God. And, you know, I listen to him every week, and I wrote in my first draft of the story, you know, I like watching him because he has a relatively secular story that he shares, and he is very positive and upbeat, and I thought his wife was kind of attractive, too. And they sent me the draft back with that line crossed out saying, I'm not allowed to sexualize the pastor's wife.
So you weren't allowed to comment.
With that one exception. But they let me say whatever I wanted to say because
well,
they
fair enough.
That
yeah.
This is not an attack on Christianity. This is me saying I have to live in a world where I have to live in a country where there are a majority of Christians, and I would love it if they came on my side, but that is not the goal of this book. The goal of this book is if I have to interact with you, I would like that interaction to be more pleasant.
Mm.
If I go to churches, I want the right information to come across about atheists, if you are talking about them, and a lot of churches are. And so that was a message that they were on board with as well. And so I think it's the first time an atheist author has written for a Christian publisher specifically. But it was a really worthwhile experience, and I'm hoping I can do it again.
Mm. Well, just briefly for us some of the main turnoffs you had in your experience of visiting churches, and then we'll have Tom sort of respond and see what he makes of those.
Sure. You know, I hear a lot of Christians talking about how, you know, God is going to decide my fate on Judgment Day. But it seems like a lot of churches want to pass that judgment on their own. They are more than willing to talk about people who are not their brand of Christianity. And when I heard some of these pastors talking, they really framed it as an us versus them debate, as in everyone who's not with us is the enemy. And, you know, it's one thing to say that people like me are going to hell. I mean, I know that's a Christian belief, but I don't mind that so much. Because I just disagree with it. But it's the idea that, you know, if you don't believe that Jesus is the way, you know, is the way and the light, etc., that you are not worth talking to, you are not a worthy human being, we should have nothing to do with you. A lot of pastors had that kind of theme in mind, and the way they're portrayed, non-Christians or atheists, was just so far off the mark of what was true. That was one of the biggest turnoffs.
Well, tell me, Tom, does that cohere with perhaps it is, you know, difficult to compare the US and the UK kind of brand of church, but is that something that you would see as being a problem yourself?
I think before I start to make a reply, I'd want to say sorry to Hemant on behalf of Christians that he's had that experience of Christians being non-inclusive and coming across as judgmental. I hope that he can forgive us for that. I would never want to come across in that way, that I was using fear as a motivation for people to believe something. I think that the only appropriate and reasonable reason to believe something is because you're convinced that it's true. And so I'm sure Hemant agrees with me from what I've read. He stands by the same sort of principle that truth comes before how we feel or what makes us happy or what works for us. And I think if you look at the example of Jesus in Scripture, I think if you look at the way that he appealed to people, very often he would try to appeal to people by connecting with them, by connecting with their questions, by connecting with their concerns, by connecting with the longings that they find in their own hearts. But at the same time, Jesus was real about the eternal situation that we are in, if the gospel is true. And he wouldn't water that down. And so at the same time as wanting to apologize, I would want to defend the ability of Christians to be able to say, these are our numbers, this is what we have been told to believe by Jesus, and we're going to stand by him.
Yeah, and Tom, I appreciate what you're saying. I actually, most of the emails I get come in two forms. One of them is the people who are apologizing to me for some of the things I've seen in church, and the other half are people who want to convert me. So I do appreciate the apology. And actually, I agree that my understanding of Jesus, as well as I know him, was exactly what Tom is saying, someone who did want to reach out to people, especially people who, you know, weren't part of his club, that's so to speak. But, you know, Tom is saying that, you know, you have to have this. Tom said he came to Christianity because of the intellectual argument for it. And that's kind of what I wanted to hear at some of these churches. And, in fact, a couple of the places I went to, one specifically said, we're going to explain to you why we know God is real, why we know Jesus is the way to God. And there was another church that had specifically a service for non-believers. And in both of those places, I was ready to hear that intellectual argument, and I didn't hear that. I heard stereotypes. I heard emotional arguments for God. And, that you know, this is another turnoff when they absolutely sidestepped any intellectual aspect there may be to believing in Christianity.
I suppose one of the things that strikes me is that some people may be listening to you, Hemant, and saying, look, what you want to go to, Hemant, is some kind of discussion forum. Church doesn't really exist to kind of give people every Sunday a list of reasons to believe in God. I mean, is that an unfair expectation?
No. I completely understand that, except a lot of the churches in America, they do want to focus on bringing people who are unchurched into the church. And as I guess I'm their target audience, and when I'm listening to what they have to say, they were doing nothing to bring me closer to their side. If anything, they were just pushing me further away. So, no, I understand that, you know, church is pretty much a place that believers go. And so, of course, I'm not going to understand some of the rituals that they're doing. And, of course, I'm not going to hear them trying to explain their beliefs because, you know, most of the people that go there are people that already believe. But, again, a lot of the churches in America, especially the evangelical churches, focus on bringing new people into the
church. And I suppose every church would want to say, we are completely open and welcoming to people who don't have a faith, who walk through our doors.
I suppose even if they're not trying to convince you that they're right, they want to be welcoming.
Yeah.
And again, that wasn't the case at a lot of places that I went.
Tom, this is a bit of a dilemma, I suppose, because, I mean, how is it that easy for churches to, I guess, do what you do for a job, really, in terms of, you know, giving those explanations? I mean, is the Sunday morning the place to do it? I don't know.
I think our understanding of apologetics, and that is the science within theology of giving answers, giving reasons for Christian belief, is that it's an intellectual subject. It's for these uber-intelligent Christian apologists who are totally almost otherworldly in the power of their brains.
Like you are, Tom.
Absolutely not. And I'm actually here to correct that stereotype because I'm not amazingly intelligent and I'm not amazingly gifted in terms of giving answers. But here's what I do know, that there are some really good reasons for being a Christian. And I think that those sorts of reasons are everyday kinds of reasons, as much as they are reasons that stretch into the more intellectual arguments. I don't think that the practice of giving reasons and giving evidences and thinking through our questions deeply, like Hemant is advocating, I don't think that that's something that is hyper-intellectual or that's something that is exclusive to, say, unpacking a passage of Scripture. Actually, I think that giving good reasons and thinking through evidence is something that goes hand in hand with unpacking Scripture properly. And I would want to talk about a kind of a sermon which would include both aspects on a Sunday morning, where we would have reasons for believing it's true as well as understanding the moral response.
I mean, on this subject, you do devote some space in your book, Hemant, to an experience you had at, I think it was Parkview Church in Chicago, where you were actually invited by the pastor to dialogue on one particular Sunday across the three services with him.
Yeah, this is a church I went to. I basically did two sets of visits. One was for Jim Henderson after he won the eBay auction, and the other set of visits I made were when writing the book. Well, for my first set of visits, I did go to this church called Parkview Church, and, you know, I said some good things about the church. I said some bad things about the church, but on the whole, in terms of, you know, my experiences, I had a pretty good one there. And the pastor said, you know what, we're doing a series of lectures on doubt, Christianity and doubt. And, you know, we're going to, this was kind of coinciding with the release of the Da Vinci Code movie. And he said, you know, I want to have a sermon where I talk about how it's okay to have doubts about Christianity. And so as part of that sermon, and actually for that sermon, why don't me and you go up on stage and just ask each other our toughest questions about the other side? And this will be impromptu speaking, so to, you know, we'll you know, we have a general idea of what we're going to ask, but not every question. And his congregation could submit questions to him ahead of time, but he would be sifting through them and weeding out the questions he thought were most important. And the congregation's job for three sermons on a Sunday, Saturday and Sunday, were just to listen and just hear this idea of how an intellectual or just emotional dialogue could take place, that even if we disagree with each other on some very important issues, we could still walk away and shake each other's hand. Hmm. And that was the point that he wanted to make, and I thought it went very well.
And you'd advocate that kind of thing as well, Tom? This type of interaction?
I think so. I think Christianity is a faith that's born out of an interaction with the questions that we have. I don't think that it's a faith that should be scared of these questions. In my experience, actually, asking those questions leads towards Christian faith and faith in Christ rather than away from it. And I'm all for advocating forums where people like Hemant can come and we can hear their perspective as well as sharing our own.
Hemant, you said the visit to Parkview was overall a good experience. What then counted as a good experience of church? What made you decide, hey, that was a good visit?
You know, usually it would look at the congregation itself. Let me tell you one thing. Of every church that I visited, most of them had greeters at the door who were more than welcoming to anyone who walked through the door. But as soon as I sat down, not a single person in any of the churches said hello to me as a stranger. None of them ever greeted me once I sat down in the pews or the chairs. But, you know, for the most part, if I saw that the congregations looked like they were happy, like they were getting along with the other people there, that to me was a good experience. If I heard what the pastor was saying, and even though it was referencing the Bible and talking about God, if it had a message that even someone like me could get on board with, that was a good experience. If they were promoting positive ideas, positive causes, you know, we are Christians, so we should get out there and help do something about the poverty in our community. That's an idea I could get on board with, even though I may not agree with the reasoning.
And did you find that not enough churches were doing that kind of thing?
No, not a lot of them were. A lot of them were more interested, to me it seemed, in just kind of building up their own church at the expense of doing things for their community. Or they were more interested in, you know, increasing their membership than they were actually having that membership do anything positive. A lot of churches.
Yeah, I guess, Tom, this is a serious criticism if churches aren't really putting their money where their mouth is, in a way. It can look somewhat selfish from an outsider's view, especially if you've got a very plush church with all the fittings and what, you know, I don't know, a revolving pulpit, etc. But they're doing actually very little in the local community.
It's not very persuasive, is it? It's not very persuasive at all. And certainly, as we understand what faith is, it's neither just a mental persuasion or assent to a set of beliefs, and neither is it merely just the way I feel or just life itself and that faith lived out. It's a combination of both. A great definition of faith is it's a kind of knowing that results in doing.
A kind of knowing that results
that
in
results
doing.
In doing. Mm. So faith is inextricably linked with that faith being lived out in practice. But I would say that it's important to recognise that even if you don't see those signs of what probably Hemant and I would call genuine community interaction, genuine openness and serving, I don't think that necessarily means that Christianity is false.
Returning to one of his earlier comments on the welcoming aspect of churches, I mean, do you go to a kind of church where people are ready to sort of you know, say hello to the person in the seat next to them?
I think I do. I think I do.
Would Hemant enjoy your church?
Well, interestingly enough, I'm between churches at the moment. I'm still attending one while I've moved slightly further out of London. I just got married 8 weeks ago.
Oh, congratulations.
So, thank you very much. Thanks, Hemant. And my wife and I are just looking around at some local churches around us, and we've been completely overwhelmed. Having gone to big churches for quite a while, I've just been bowled over by how much love a little church of 30 or 40 people can show. I mean, the day after going to one, we were invited to lunch, we were invited out for a cup of tea. Just such a warm reception, asked if there's anything that they can do for us. And I think, you know, often we have this perception that churches aren't going to be as friendly as perhaps they can be. And maybe there are good reasons. We've all had experiences, I think, where churches haven't lived up to the standard that we'd like them to live up to, or that Jesus would like them to live up to. But I have to say, my experiences recently show me that some churches are really doing very well.
Mm. That's funny that Tom says that, because most of the smaller churches I went to were the ones where I got little or no reception. And in fact, people were sitting far away from me. Maybe it's because I'm brown and I walked into like these very small white churches, and they were like, "What is he doing here?" And they just kind of moved away. But usually it was the smaller churches where I figured, you know, they all know each other because they're small. So if they see a stranger come in, they would be more open than even some of the bigger ones to introduce themselves and, like Tom said, take me out for a drink or tea or something like that. And actually, I got less response at those churches than I did even the mega churches.
That's interesting, because they often say that the mega churches kind of breed some kind of, you know, anonymity type of thing, you know, because they're so big. But you kind of had the opposite experience, which is quite interesting. Let me just, before we go on with this conversation, say that if you're listening and you'd like to respond to anything Hemant or Tom have said on the programme so far, you're more than welcome to email me, and I shall pass on your comments to them and indeed read them out next week. Our email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you'd like to leave a voicemail message, that's also an option. You can go to 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Once again, ring 08456 52 52 52, select option 5, and leave me a voicemail message.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I got the impression from your book, Hemant, that for you, big is beautiful, because in many ways it was at these mega churches, as they're described, that you had perhaps the most positive experiences, and you devote actually one chapter to your experiences at three mega churches in particular. Now, we haven't got a lot of time in this section to go into that. Maybe we'll look at it a bit more in the next one. But what was it in general about the approach of the big service and the facilities that they could offer that attracted you?
Well, it wasn't so much how they looked, but they obviously have more money, and they have the ability to do so many great things. You know, there was one lady that went to one of those types of churches that emailed me and said, and I couldn't do it because I was out of town that weekend, but she said, you know, as a Christian, I want to do something good for my community. So a group of people from my church are going to go do this community service project for a couple, and we are inviting as many people as we can to do this with us, and we don't care if they go to our church or if they go to church at all. We just want to do this thing for this elderly couple. We want to fix up their house without kind of telling them. They were going to do I don't know if you get this show, Extreme Makeover Home Edition. They wanted to kind of send them away out of town, fix up their house while they were gone, and bring them back.
Wow.
It was amazingly, just a beautiful project they were doing. And they were compelled to do it because this is the type of thing their large church advocates. And that's amazing when a church can really make people do that. I read of another church that gave, you know, instead of passing around a collection plate, they passed around a collection plate full of envelopes, and people's job was not to put money in the collection plate. It was to take an envelope out of it. And inside of an envelope, after everyone collected one, they had money inside, $5, $10, $20, $100, and one person in each of their five services got $1,000 in their envelope.
Wow.
They were told by their pastor, and again, this is only because it's a big church and they can afford to do this.
Yeah.
They were told, take this money, you're not allowed to give it back to the church, get out into the community, do something worthwhile with it. you know, help someone out, because that's our job as a church. Even if we're not giving you money, this is what you should be doing. And the stories that they got back in response were just so incredible. And this is the type of thing that only, and it was this idea of just paying it forward, helping other people, seeing if one, you know, donating here could lead to more donations on another place.
Well, those were obviously very positive experiences. And Tom, you say that you
can only do at big churches.
Well, indeed. Yeah. I mean, Tom, you say you've been to perhaps not churches on the scale of Willow Creek or that sort of thing. But can you see an argument there, Tom, in terms of a bigger church is able to have a big impact, I suppose?
Well, I was living in California for 5 months last year, and I had some experience going to some very large churches there. And I certainly can see that the combined effect of a huge number of people together could have a wonderful effect, like Hemant's describing. And I just think that's so exciting to hear about a church really engaging with the people who are coming. I think for me, that's a big part of what church is all about.
Well, we're going to have more time to look at Hemant's experiences, because I think that's one of the most interesting aspects, the comments Hemant has to say about some of these big mega churches, because they're so often in our consciousness these days. You know, they're the ones you see on TV and that get interviews on the radio, etc. And so we'll continue to look at this, gentlemen, and you, I hope, will continue to listen, dear listener. So we'll be back in just a few moments' time, and we're going to be continuing our conversation with atheist Hemant Mehta, who sold his soul on eBay and went to church in response, and he's written a book about his experiences, and we're asking the question today, along with Tom Price from the Damaris Trust: how good is the church at communicating God? Welcome back. Next week on this programme, Unbelievable, you can hear a special discussion between a rabbi and a Christian. We're going to be meeting, once again, Rabbi Reuben Livingstone, an Orthodox Jewish rabbi, and we're going to be looking at the subject of salvation as Jewish people perceive it. We're also going to be hearing from Alex Jacob of the Church's Ministry Among Jewish People, as he gives a Christian perspective. So that's our discussion topic next week, salvation, and that's with a Jewish and a Christian perspective on the issue next week. Do hope you can join me then between 2 and 3:30 p.m.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Now, I wonder what an atheist would make of your Sunday morning church service if they were to walk in unannounced. Well, Hemant Mehta walked in to a number of different church services around the Chicago area and beyond, and he's told of his experience in I Sold My Soul on eBay, and we've already been looking at some of the particular things he found both positive and negative in the churches that he visited. And we're going to be continuing to look at that, as well as Hemant's own, you know, personal take on atheism and Christianity and that sort of thing. So that's our subject today. And I wonder, how well does your church communicate God to non-believers? What are the things that Hemant's pointed out that Christians would do well to listen to and to actually bear in mind when it comes to putting that message out there? My other guest on the programme today is Tom Price from the Damaris Trust. He's a Christian evangelist and apologist. You describe in your book, Hemant, a number of experiences at smaller churches where obviously there was that feeling that it had its downsides, and you then describe in some detail going to three mega churches, as they're called. Now, these were quite different in their way. One of them was the church run by Rob Bell, which is called Mars Hill Bible Church. Many may have seen Rob Bell in the Numa DVDs, which are quite popular among Christian groups and churches. Describe sort of what you found good about that particular experience.
Well, you know, at that church, it's a huge church, but you would never know it based on the, you know, that it was basically a big empty space, like in a rundown mall that they had been donated. It's just a big empty space with a stage in the middle. So it's definitely not using the money to, you know, make itself look nice. There were no signs saying, come to Mars Hill Church. There wasn't even a sign on the door that said it was Mars Hill Church. You either knew it was there or it wasn't. Or you didn't, you know, and a lot of people, you know, if you wanted to go to church, you would know how to get there. And Rob was one of the few pastors willing to talk to me because he was excited by the idea of talking to someone like me who was interested in going to churches and learning about kind of the social aspects of it, how it presents itself. So he was one of the few pastors that was willing to talk to me as opposed to a lot of the other church pastors I visited. One of the interesting things I saw at his church, though, is, you know, one of the first things they did is a guy got up on stage and asked if anyone had read the newspaper, their local newspaper that morning, and said, you know, one of the headlines was talking about how 1 in 5 people in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where they were from, was living below the poverty line. And their question was, what are we doing as a church to help correct this problem? That's how they opened their service. And, you know, they talked a little bit more about that. I think they did more of it after the service than I would have liked to see them do, you know, than they did during the service, which is unfortunate. But this was an issue they felt that they had to address as a church. And this is not something you saw at a lot of other megachurches. So I really like that approach, that it's one of the things Rob said that really was compelling to me was that he said, you know, the church is not the four walls that I am going to be preaching in, basically. The church is the bars we go into. The church is well beyond, you know, this building. The church is everywhere. So if we are not doing everything we can to follow Jesus in, you know, just outside these walls, we're not a good church.
Interestingly, the next example of a megachurch, to my mind, is quite different to that, is Joel Osteen's Lakewood Church, which is supposed to be the largest in America, I understand. Where I think you'd probably agree they have spent a bit on making it look nice inside and that kind
of
thing.
They have a waterfall behind Joel when he preaches. So, yeah, they spent a little bit of money on
it. But you also really appreciated Joel's way of presenting things as well, I understand.
Right, and I think probably more so than most Christians, because a lot of Christians don't like Joel because he doesn't refer to the Bible a whole lot. And if you ever see him on TV, which I do a lot, if you ever, you know, had a chance to see him, he basically refers to maybe 1 or 2 passages in the Bible and uses it as a starting off point to talk. And he preaches something called the prosperity gospel, that, you know, if you have faith in God, you could get that promotion, you could get more money, you could have a happier marriage. But, you know, a lot of those ideas are also ideas that can appeal to people who are not Christian, and he doesn't rely on the Bible so heavily that it's a turnoff to people like me. You know, the things he was saying about how we need to be more compassionate, how we need to communicate with other people, those are things anyone could get behind, and, you know, you leave the church feeling kind of happy.
And your mom's a fan too, I understand.
My mom's a huge fan. I'm a huge fan, yeah. I mean, if I wake up on a Sunday morning and I'm with my parents, Joel's on TV, and it's not because my parents are Christians either, you know?
That's really interesting, and I suppose gives maybe an insight into why his ministry is so popular.
It reaches to a lot of people. Now, I don't think Joel's ever going to convert someone to Christianity, because he probably couldn't. I don't know.
I don't know.
On Christianity.
He might not convert you, Hemant, but I'm guessing there are a lot of people out there who would warm to the way he does things. I mean, just finally and briefly, the third mega church you profile is Willow Creek Community Church, which is well known for its approach of putting on seeker sensitive services. So it very much has an approach every Sunday of trying to appeal to people in your position.
Yeah, and Willow Creek, again, they had some of the best speakers I've ever seen, and that's even not counting churches. I mean, just in general, some of the best speakers I've ever seen. They had services where, yes, they do rely more heavily on the Bible, but even then, I left the services with questions in mind about how am I living my life, things like that. At the same time, you know, I knew that even though they didn't talk about it on Sundays or Wednesday nights during their major services, I know that during the course of the week they have programs that talk about why being homosexual is a bad thing, and they talk about why intelligent design is the correct way of science. And these are things I have really strong arguments against, and I really think they're doing a disservice by doing that stuff. But again, this is not what they were talking about during the services that I attended.
Okay, well
they do a lot of good things, they also have the power to do a lot of bad things.
Well, obviously, you had positive and negative experiences, but overall, in the book, you say that the churches that do have the most impact and the most likelihood, in a sense, of bringing you back, were that kind of a church. I mean, Tom, you know, those of us who live in the realm of, you know, church on Sunday with maybe 50 to 100 people, but probably, you know, are thinking, well, we can't really compete with that kind of stuff. You know, we can't pull in Bill Hybels every Sunday just to kind of motivate us. But what do you think, Tom? Are there things we can learn, you know, in our maybe more smaller, more provincial setting from what Hemant is saying?
I find that a couple of things are coming across to me from what Hemant's saying. I think number one is that Hemant's keen to see teaching that's relevant, speaking that's relevant, and teaching that looks outside the church too, that isn't just about these what happens in between these four walls, but breaking out as the gospel breaks out of the Hebrew Israelite community, out to the Gentiles, out to everyone else. And I think the second thing that I'm hearing is that Hemant is saying that reasons should form part of that discussion, that we shouldn't separate our speaking and our preaching from giving and thinking reasons through properly. So I think I'm there actually, thinking that he's onto some good things here. He's saying some interesting things, and I want to see those reasons mentioned more in church too.
And what kind of reasons would you be would you point to yourself for if someone like Hemant was to walk through your doors, Tom, and want to have a discussion with you?
Well, here's an opportunity for me to share how I don't think that giving reasons and evidence for Christian faith has to be a massively intellectual business. I just think that the historical person of Jesus, if he really did and said all that stuff, if he grew back limbs in plain sight, knew the future, raised people from the dead, prophesied his own death and then rose from the dead, if he did all that stuff, then I'm wondering if our search for God might be over. And so the question becomes, did he really do and say that stuff? I mean, that's not something that's a particularly complicated argument. I think anybody could explain that. But it really does help us to think through what exactly we base our faith on.
Hemant, have you kind of had opportunity to look into those kind of areas of the justification that someone like Tom would give for the reality of who Jesus is and said he was?
Some of it, not a lot of it, but I have put enough thought into it where, you know, I'm at the point where I start reading books about how the Bible was written and, you know, how much of it do we know is true from a historical perspective. And that goes beyond, like, the miracles of Jesus. That's kind of saying, you know, here's how we know one person wrote this section versus multiple authors writing something else. And that's something that's really fascinating to me. You know, how did this Bible come together? And what can we take as the misinterpretation of scribes? What can we take as a really historical approach to it that, you know, is accurate and something we can rely on? And usually that doesn't involve the miracle stories. It involves kind of the historical aspects of who was real at the time, who was a mythical character, things like that. Mm. So those are things I've started to look into and I'm continuing to do.
I mean, I think I've got a list here of 12 facts which are agreed on by the most skeptical New Testament scholars. Number one, Jesus died by crucifixion. Number two, Jesus was buried. Number three, Jesus' death caused his followers to begin to despair and lose hope, believing that his life had ended. And then number four, Jesus' tomb was found to be empty just a few days later. The disciples of Jesus began to have these experiences where they actually believed Jesus had literally risen from the dead. And then they were transferred from doubters to being afraid to identify with Jesus, suddenly into bold proclaimers of his death and resurrection. And I have further facts on top of these, which support the idea that the New Testament is a historically accurate and authentic picture of what really happened.
I mean, do you have to, in a sense, have these facts at your fingertips? I mean, for you, Hemant, would you be persuaded by an argument which said, well, if you look at it historically, the things that the gospel says happened appear to have happened. I mean, would that tell you that therefore God does exist in some way?
I think the point where I have issue with is when it comes to those supernatural explanations for it. You know, let's say the body wasn't there. Well, how do we know that it really did rise from the dead? Why couldn't there have been a different explanation for it that we just haven't thought about or they didn't think about at the time? Those are the things where I get, you know, where things confuse me. And, you know, when Jesus raises people from the dead, well, you know, how would we know they were medically, historically dead? Because I've never seen it happen now. things like that. That's where I have issue with. It's not necessarily that whether or not Jesus got crucified. It's more the supernatural explanations that the writers of the Bible ascribe to him.
So in a sense, you're worried that what they ascribed to supernatural events, we, in the light of modern thinking and science, would be able to say, well, they obviously misinterpreted that.
Yeah, or they weren't looking at all the possible explanations for it, sure.
I think now scholars are reflecting and evaluating theories about what happened to Jesus' body and whether it could have been taken somewhere else. And my feeling is, reading that scholarship by people like Gary Habermas, Mike Lycona, William Lane Craig, is that these theories that somebody stole the body just doesn't weigh up with what we do know. For example, the Roman guard was under a sentence of death if it left the tomb unguarded. And that the body was... The proclamation that the resurrection had occurred was in Jerusalem, and if the authorities had stolen the body, then that proclamation wouldn't have happened there. It would have been somewhere else. The very first people who reported the resurrection were not people who were well respected. They were women who in that culture were not respected well. And so it has all the marks of an authentic historical case. And I think we have to be very careful not to just rule out an explanation because it involves the supernatural. That would be bias.
One of the things that I did write in the book is that it would kind of take a miracle. I would actually have to witness a miracle myself if I wanted to really be convinced of the supernatural being a possibility of being true.
Hemant, do you think that places you in the position of almost playing God, being God, by saying, God, I kind of want to believe, I'm open to believe, but you do something for me, and then I'll believe. I mean, God might say that I've already done this
right.
miracle in history, and if you're not going to believe on the basis of that, then why should I jump to your tune?
Well, I think part of it is that the churches say that the miracles still happen. They are adamant that miracles still do happen, and I get a lot of emails of people telling me their miracle stories, all of which have a very, very natural possible explanation to them. I heard someone asking me, you know, someone said, even if the bones of Jesus were to be dug up somewhere, I would still have faith that those were planted by the devil or something like that.
Oh, no, on the contrary, the New Testament won't let anybody claim that. The New Testament says in 1 Corinthians 15 that if the resurrection did not happen, then our faith is useless. So if somebody produced the bones of Jesus, that would falsify Christian belief. And in the New Testament understanding of Christian faith, that would be a serious problem.
I mean, you're saying, though, Hemant, it would need a miracle that was undeniably, you know, supernatural, something like a limb growing back or Jesus appearing in front of you.
I think that's one way of showing me something that it's really hard for me to make that jump to saying that those things actually happen. So that's one way of doing it. It's not the only way, but that's probably going to be the most fast, most convincing way to show me anything. And no, I'm not putting God to the test or anything like that, but it's hard for me to take that aspect of the Bible, to take that aspect of any faith seriously when I don't feel like I've ever experienced that, or that's really the biggest jump for me to go across. It's not the idea that Jesus could have been a real person or that he was crucified. Those are not the issues I have with it. The issues come when those supernatural aspects come about and how people can believe certain aspects of the supernatural world so easily when I don't feel like there's any evidence for that.
Is Hemant here, Tom, almost, in a sense we call it faith because there is an element of faith involved. Does this Hemant's requirement for a supernatural, obviously supernatural miracle, kind of do away with, you know, mean that he wouldn't have to have put faith in it because it would be so obvious or something like that?
I'd want to make a distinction between faith itself, which is a persuasion of your mind that things are real, which results in doing this kind of knowing that results in action, and the act of faith. Christianity is described by Jesus as a step into the light, not a step into the darkness. Ignorance isn't a virtue when it comes to Christian faith. And so I think that while I'm really sitting here empathizing with what Hemant's saying, that when it comes to the crunch times in life, you really want to know that this stuff's real. For me, the process and the journey of becoming a Christian was actually partly to recognize that I couldn't demand of God the proof that I wanted him to produce for me, but that I had to sit back and say, okay, God, if you're really God, what have you done in history? And to be open to that happening.
Hemant, I mean, Was there anything in the churches that you visited that helped you in any way to, if not to believe Christianity, that put it in a more positive light for you, that did answer some questions you might have had, at least, about the faith?
Not really, but I did see that Christianity could be a force for good with some of the people that I met in the churches and some of the projects they were doing as a result of their being Christian. So it's more that, you know what, Christianity could be a positive force. My bigger problem, I mean, if you want to debate kind of whether God exists or whether the New Testament is, you know, to be believed the way it was written, you know, you could bring a quote-unquote an atheist apologist on. My concern, I mean, the work I do with atheist organizations in America isn't so much about convincing people that we're right and they're wrong. Our concern pretty much lies with the idea when Christians try to force their beliefs onto other people. And I'm sure Tom would agree with me on this. I mean, if anything, it has to be an intellectual journey. My problem is when, you know, religion and government intertwine, when they try to push it into the classrooms, when they try to force their beliefs into legislation. That's more the issue that I have aspect with. That's kind of where I see some of the megachurches having negative power, where they try to legislate these things. And less so with necessarily the historical accuracies or inaccuracies of what the Bible says. So that's more the work that I do. And so I don't spend a lot of time arguing the pros and cons or rather the truth or non-truth of Christianity. Because honestly, I'm not really interested in whether someone's a Christian or not. It's kind of what they do with it that I'm more concerned about.
I mean, would you agree broadly with Hemant's point there, Tom, that Christians do sometimes try to force Christianity into spheres where it shouldn't be in the first place? I don't know.
I think it's got to be honestly and open-handedly admitted that we don't get it right sometimes, and that we sometimes invoke force or manipulate people towards Christian belief. And I think that's wrong. I don't think we should be making overly emotional appeals to people to try and manipulate them to make a commitment. I don't think we should be using force to elicit commitment to Jesus either. And I think, looking back to the example of Jesus, he was incredibly attractive as a personality. Anthony Flew, the atheist who has recently moved over, reconsidered his opinion, moved to deism, recounting the experiences in his book There Is a God, published a couple of weeks ago, said that when you combine the two figures of Jesus and the Apostle Paul, it really does seem like that's the that's a very convincing case for monotheism. And I think when you look back to this incredibly attractive character of Jesus, you do see that he lets hundreds of people walk away. He lets them choose whether they're going to respond to the gospel, this message that God created the world and that we need his rescue and help. And I think Jesus really lets people walk away.
I mean, one thing...
To the best of my understanding, I agree with Tom, and there are a lot of books out in the Christian market that are things like talking about people who are not churched or who are not Christian that say they like Jesus, they just don't like Christians, or they like Jesus but they don't like the church. You almost wish more people would be like Jesus, and they are completely the opposite, at least by my interpretation or what I know about him.
I think Jesus always sets things up along the lines of saying, don't judge Christians, but judge me. Jesus said, look at me and judge me. Who do you think I am? And I think Christians, we need to point back to Jesus more and not say, look at me as an example of whether or not Christianity is true. Don't look at the church necessarily as your only example of whether or not Christianity is true, but look at the person of Jesus in history.
Let me just say, before we start to wrap up our thoughts on this afternoon's programme, that if you want to get in touch with me, perhaps you've been listening to what Tom and Hemant have been saying, and you'd like to put your point of view across in these areas of whether the Bible really, you know, is true in what it says about Jesus, or indeed about any of the points that Hemant's been making about churches and the way they put faith across. You're welcome, again, to email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Love getting your emails, and very happy to forward them on to my guests as well. You can also phone in your response to our voicemail line. That's 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Leave me a voicemail message there. I'll play it out on next week's programme, and any that are relevant, I'm very happy as well to forward again to our guests on the programme this afternoon.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
And if you have access to the internet, and to be honest, most people these days, certainly most people I know do have, you can listen to this programme online, of course. You may be listening live online, but you can listen again at the web page. Go to premier.org.uk/radio and click on Unbelievable. That's premier.org.uk/radio. Click on Unbelievable. It's available there to download as an MP3. There's plenty of past shows there as well. Well, we're approaching the end of our programme with Hemant Mehta, who wrote the book I Sold My Soul on eBay, in which he tells of his experience as an atheist visiting a number of churches in America, both for good and for bad, and finishes up really by telling us what it would take to convince him of the truth of God, which is what we've been talking about in our last section. I mean, one thing that you do make clear, Hemant, is that you want to kind of overcome this them and us mentality. You want this kind of dialogue to occur more frequently between Christians and atheists.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, despite the differences, I think there are a lot of issues that even the most fundamental of Christians and atheists and other faiths could completely agree on, things like, you know, fixing the poverty issue, making, you know, just having more rights for certain types of people, at least things I would hope more people would get on board with. But I think when there are issues that we can agree on, things like doing volunteer work, things like community service, it would be very interesting, I think, if more churches would reach out to people that don't necessarily attend their church when they do some of their projects. And I don't think a lot of churches really do that. I've seen a lot of atheist groups on college campuses, at least the ones I've worked with, that when they do volunteer projects, they actually ask the other faith groups on campus if they would like to join them in doing it. And I think that makes a very compelling case, the fact that we can work together even though we may have very different viewpoints on things that are very fundamental.
Well,
and I wish more churches would take a lead in doing that.
Well, it's been great to have you on board and to have this discussion with you, Hemant, over the
thank
last...
Thank you very much. And if I can just ask your listeners if they're interested in contacting me or just participating in more of this type of dialogue, they're welcome to go to friendlyatheist.com.
Friendlyatheist.com. Okay, thank you so much, Hemant. Tom, thank you as well. Any final thoughts in regard to the programme today?
It's been really fun to talk to Hemant, and I think we can all learn a great deal from what he's saying. And I'd encourage people to look up Hemant's website and to engage with the questions he's asking, as well as checking out the Damaris Trust website, which
of course.
at www.damaris.org.
Thank you, gentlemen, both for being with me today as we've looked at how the church communicates God. And once more, Hemant's book is I Sold My Soul on eBay. You can get it through the Premier website too if you go to our bookshop. That's premier.org.uk/shop. You've been listening to Unbelievable. My guests have been Hemant Mehta and Tom Price from the Damaris Trust. Let's have a quick look at what's coming up this time next week. You're unbelievable. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Orthodox Rabbi Reuben Livingstone and Christian Alex Jacob, and they're going to be discussing salvation. We're going to be looking at what Jews believe about salvation and what Christians believe, and having a little bit of a debate over the subject. Hope you can join me again for this programme at that time next week. Father John Twistleton's here next with Firmly I Believe. I'll bid you goodbye until next week.